tsunami, you know, a local tsunami, Big Island generated would probably be like the worst case scenario, you know, for Kauai.
How many ambulances are there on the island?
You know, at any one time, you've got an ambulance in Hanalei, in Kapa'a, in Lahui, in Kailua, and then... Kilauea. Oh, yeah, now it's in Kilauea, yeah. Lahui, and then you have Waimea. So that's it for the whole island.
So in a major disaster with a lot of people hurt, that's not many.
Yeah, they have extra vehicles. They have extra ambulances and more personnel that they could call back. So, but still, yeah, not a lot.
I think what we learned in the hurricane is that right when those emergencies like that are really happening, it's kind of the citizens buckling down and following the rules. Like that's part of the civil defense program, which I'm sure coordinates with you as well. Yeah.
Yeah, civil defense is really what is the overseer of the CERT program. That's who would activate CERT volunteers if there was a disaster.
And civil defense has been really quite good with the phone calls when there's a problem, and we've had a few fire drills when there's been earthquakes, so we've expected a tsunami. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, across all the islands, been very good at getting just about everybody up to high ground. There's been a few stubborn people who don't want to go, but better safe than sorry, and I think
always.
It's been a good example of that. Now, I think in a few weeks we're probably going to have we're going to try and get civil defense in here in the Ham Radio Club. Is that correct, Marshall?
I have just reached out, so
okay.
I can't say for sure.
That's his responsibility, but to get them in here. But we're looking at doing that. It's always really important to be prepared on that. So
that's a big part of CERT too, is the Kauai Amateur Radio Club, and we really work hand in hand. A lot of the ham radio operators are also CERT volunteers. So, you know, one of the critical functions is even after, say, a hurricane, communications is going to go down. Cell phones aren't going to work. Internet's not going to work. You know, even text messaging will be gone. And ham radio is pretty foolproof, so we can get really accurate information from different communities into the EOC, or the Emergency Operating Center in Lahui, which is kind of like the, you know, the command post or the hub where police and fire and all the different agencies would be. But, yeah, the Amateur Radio Club is awesome. They've really supported both Red Cross and CERT. And, yeah, big shout out to them.
And Kauai Community Radio actually got its start from some FEMA money, some federal money, because we didn't have radio up here for, I don't know, probably better part of the year, a long time. And so it was a big piece of why KKCR is up here. And sometimes people say, oh, it's so North Shore. Yes, it's North Shore. Because even when we have the flooding in the roads and the road breaks, and if you have something like a tsunami, we have low-lying highways, so especially in the Wailua area and Kealia. So really, we would be cut off for a long time.
Yeah.
So that's correct. So we have this radio station, which is one thing. We got the generator in the backup. You never know if the towers go down or don't go down, but that's one piece that we have for communication.
And that's, again, yeah, the CERT program. I mean, we teach people how to take care of themselves and try and, you know, reestablish order in their communities. There's going to be a tremendous amount of chaos, and it's like an organized fashion. You might not see police or fire personnel for days in your community, depending on where you live, you know. So.
And so you got some classes coming up right now, right? Like even today? Is that starting tonight?
Yeah, we got a class starting in Kilauea tonight. Basically, the CERT basic 24-hour class, it's the basic training class. And what we do is we do six consecutive nights. We're doing
consecutive weeks.
Weeks, yeah.
On the same night,
so
yeah. Kilauea tonight is Tuesday. For 6 weeks, people would commit to a Tuesday night.
Yeah.
I would be doing it, except I'm on the air on Tuesday nights.
Right. It's well, Lahui class is coming up later on in March. I think that starts on the 30th.
Okay.
And that will be at our fire headquarters in Lahui. But it's a 24-hour basic training, so we do six 4-hour sessions. And in that training, you learn about disaster preparedness. You learn about what's called the Incident Command System.
Mm-hmm.
It's an organizational structure that basically is a result of 9/11.
9/11 being the incident that happened in New York
with the World Trade Center, right. And what happened is there was a lot of different agencies responding to that, and they weren't speaking the same language. Everybody had like kind of a different program going on. So what ICS does, or the Incident Command System, it's just an organizational framework where, you know, police, fire, CERT, EMS, everybody's speaking the same language. And it's just amazing the way it's written. I mean, it could be as small as a birthday party, or it could be as large as a national event. And the Incident Command System can like grow or shrink depending on its need, you know.
Yeah. And go ahead. You were going to ask a question? No. One thing after the hurricane happened, sorry to keep going back to that, but I think it's a really good example. I know at my home, we didn't have phone for probably 6 months. It was kind of nice, actually. Yeah. We didn't have television. Not that we had a lot before, but we didn't have any for 2 years. We didn't have electric for 2.5 months, except we were solar, so we were fine. Almost felt guilty. But we didn't have water for 18 days. So there's a lot of things, but it was actually kind of fun because everybody was so loving to each other. It like brought out the best of everybody, and all the humbug between people was just gone. Though, shout out to the military. They were a hero. They kind of flew in the next day and came in on big boats, and they were sort of everywhere and brought in food, and FEMA people were here. And so we were lucky that we had that. I don't know what would happen if Oahu had that.
Right. Well, that's just the thing. I mean, if it's just here on Kauai and the National Guard from Oahu is able to get over here pretty quick, yeah, that's great. But if it's a statewide event, we're not going to see resources for a while, you know. And, you know, here on Kauai, we got about 3 days worth of resources, you know, Home Depot, Walmart, everything's going to sell out of everything real fast if those mats and containers aren't coming in like clockwork. So, you know, part of the thing we teach people is just to be prepared, you know, be ready during those events and have, you know, your supplies in place.
And how about if it's a non-event, like just a shipping strike or an economic piece where things don't come over? I mean, that what about food and resource mapping around the communities? Is that things that you train?
Not really. No, it's more disaster response. It's really just bridging the gap between a disaster and when emergency responders can arrive. But in the class, you would learn about the preparedness and, you know, if they did run out of water and food for, you know, if the mats and containers, you'd be better off than other people that weren't prepared, you know.
Mm-hmm. So what are you suggesting for food? And can you just give us some examples of, like, I know there's 6 weeks. Is there a main title of what each night does?
As far as the food thing, I think if you go to the county, if you go to just kauai.gov, you'll go to the county website, and they have lists there.
Of what CERT does?
Yeah, and also, like, how to be prepared, like, you know, a hurricane preparedness checklist. They're all over the place. Like Red Cross has them, CERT has them, Civil Defense has them. A lot of the faith-based organizations have, you know, preparedness lists of just things that you should have at all times in case there's a, you know, a disaster. Then going to the classes, again, the first class is the just disaster preparedness. You get into the ICS or the CERT organization, the Incident Command System. We teach people emergency medical operations, you know, so we teach the CERTs how to take care of the killers, you know, treating for shock, controlling bleeding, you know, opening the airway, how to basically just keep people alive in the short term, splinting and bandaging, you know, a lot of just really practical things that you never know when you might have to use.
You might need them without without a disaster.
Absolutely.
And Marshall, you just finished one of the classes and you seemed very enthusiastic about it. What was your biggest takeaways?
Well, the triage, the medical triage, was something that really impressed me. What do you do if there are no emergency medical responders around and there are a lot of people hurt? You know, that's a really challenging situation. So just to have even a few people who know how to go about sorting people out and prioritizing people, you know, I mean, literally labeling them, establishing a morgue for one thing, establishing a treatment area.
Yeah, that's the thing about the program too. I mean, there's some heavy stuff, you know. I mean, it's like you prepare, you hope for the best, but you prepare for the worst, you know. And the thing is, we don't want to discourage anybody from joining the CERT program if they're like afraid of blood and guts and things like that or trauma, because there's a lot of other things that you can do, you know. And it's kind of like, if we, you know, if the fire department and the police department needed all hands on deck, all we need is just people to show up to a staging area and be able to help out in any capacity, but do it in a safe fashion. I mean, the theme that runs throughout all of the CERT classes is just safety, safety, safety. We're not asking anybody to put themselves in harm's way or do, you know, what the fire department or police department do. So it's really just about being able to help out and then also follow the chain of command so you're not just freelancing and doing things on your own, but you're in a organized, you know, you're following the chain of command. Because, again, you know, even talking to some older police officers and firefighters, the people that got hurt after a NICI, it was after the event, you know.
Yes.
It wasn't during. It was just doing reckless things after. So safety and then following team leaders is, you know, really critical in this program.
That was another thing, how to safely determine whether or not you can enter a damaged building to look for survivors who may be inside. And if you determine that you can enter, how to go about when you're inside a damaged building, finding people who may be anywhere in there, systematically going around the building and getting them out.
Right.
You know, what I found really important after the hurricane, I'm just going to ask, I started to take CERT a few years back, maybe 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. The class didn't quite go all the way through to completion, but something that was really important to me, because I had the surf shop in town, is mapping where the community people are. Mapping where the community people are, because there are things that are needed to know, like who has a nursing baby, who needs insulin, who needs these things. Because what was wonderful is the different islands came over. We had Island Air working in Princeville, and even those employees would come over, and they came just blindly with the need to help, say, I'm just thinking of diabetics, because they did come to my store, and they're like, they came, and it was like, here, we have all this stuff for diabetics. Who's diabetic? And I'm thinking, you know, and we did have a verbal chain that kind of got a lot of that distributed pretty quickly, but it was just because it was a small community that knew each other, and I think having maps of who needs what kind of medications, what what vulnerabilities are different places, because when you have key businesses that are likely to be open, that they can be distribution points. Is that part of the CERT stuff or the civil defense?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the components is like called mapping your community, and it's about going out and, you know, finding out who in your neighborhood needs what. Like you said, there's a lot of diabetics, and their insulin has to be refrigerated. There's a lot of medications that need refrigeration, and if you lose power and don't have a generator, that's going to open up a whole other can of worms as far as like medical conditions, and you know, a lot of things are going to go south quick. So yeah, we encourage people to go map their community, find out who needs what, take care of people in your community. During the last tsunami evacuation, someone in Waimea Town just got left behind. You know, they're unaccounted for, and it was an elderly person that no one accounted for that person. And then all of a sudden, they're like, "Hey, you know, we're so and so," and somebody had to rush back down in there just before it was, you know, supposed to hit, make landfall and pull them out. So, yeah, a lot of it's just it's accountability. And then, you know, in the CERT program, there's so much about just accountability if you're helping out, not just doing whatever, but, you know, working with a team and people and, know where you're at and what you're doing.
And it sounds like personal responsibility is a big part of this. Like if you have a vulnerability or you are related to somebody with a vulnerability, that might be a good team leader to be making sure that there is some solutions on it. Yeah. And you know, we had a generator and then we were selling propane refrigerators, so we were able to keep these things cold. So we became a little bit of a good key spot, but all of that's really important. Yeah. I have Alan and Greg in here. Alan, do you want to share something?
Yeah,
tell us what your role is.
I'm the I'm in CERT. I live in Kilauea. I happen to be the Kilauea team leader for CERT.
Mm. Okay,
a mantle I would gladly give up to anybody. It's a very small ad hoc group of folks, all with the same training. And one of the things I'd like to ask John to describe is we're going to have this island-wide refresher next year in May, which, to my money, last year was the single most valuable experience I've yet had in CERT, because we had a chance to put it all together in one place and work together as communities. And I think people would be interested in your description of what that's all about and when it's going to be this year.
Okay, so the annual refresher is basically everything that we do during the 24-hour basic training class, and then we make it real life. We go down to Kauai High School, and we set up triage. We get a lot of the students, thanks to the Key Club, you know, at Kauai High. And then this year, the JROTC kids at Kapaa High School, they're actually doing a teen CERT class right now. And we just make kind of real-life scenarios, and we put people in groups, and some of them already have designated team leaders, depending on their community. Others are just showing up and participating. We make it an educational experience. We don't want to put a lot of pressure on, you know, the certs that are volunteering, but we want to make it real life. You know, so the kids are moulashed up and they've got broken arms and legs and they're screaming. So they practice the triage. They practice some search and rescue things. They practice communication with the ham radio and things like that. So we do everything in the class, but we make it live. And it's just a good annual refresher.
And that, I guess that's one of the things that makes it something so worthy, going to the class as opposed to just filming it and putting it on Hoike, even though that's a good idea, but it's then you're actually being able to physically practice it and do it.
I think you got to have a lot of the hands-on experience. And then, too, you know, I wanted to go back with the CERT program. We kind of have three levels of participation. You know, some people take the class, and it's just so that they're not part of the problem. You know, it's just education so that, you know, they are prepared and they're not going to be a part of the problem. We have other people that take the class, and, you know, at the end of the class, you get, like, personal protective equipment. So you get a helmet, a backpack, you get a reflective vest, some gloves, things to basically protect your hands, your eyes, your lungs, you know. And then also we can identify you with that. So, you know, people have a CERT ID, so they're actually, you know, checking into the incident command system. And they might be assigned to a firefighter. It's kind of like a force multiplier. But the second group of people are people that take the class and are like, you know what, I can't go to monthly trainings and being doing something every week, but if there's a disaster, I would show up and I'd try and help out. So that's the second group. And then the third group, you know, are, you know, folks like Greg and Alan that are very, very supportive of the program, and they like to help out in any way, shape, or form. You know, so that's why they kind of naturally rise to the top as team leaders, because they understand the program a lot more. And, you know, they're more reliable resources. It's like any volunteer organization. There's some people drifting out there, and you don't quite know if they're going to show up or not, you know. So that's not really a reliable resource. So, you know, we try and let people know, hey, if you want to just take the class for education, that's fine.
Okay. And then, like, the canine rescue, is that part of your thing? The hunters, they were amazing in the last time. You know, there's certain people in the carpenters, builders.
Yeah.
People kind of just really came out of the woodwork.
They're kind of like natural certs. Yeah. They're like just, I mean, they're doing the same thing and they haven't taken the training. And, you know, that's the thing we realize too. There's so many incredibly competent people in the community that, you know, they're not in the cert program, but we have a way of dealing with spontaneous volunteers too. You know, that's a
yeah, and I think it's a good moment for me to give a shout out to these communities of people like the hunters, for example, and the fishermen and right. the people who are not afraid to go up high or do different things. Sometimes that's a community that doesn't get revered as much as they should when we see sure. a real problem because they really are able to show up.
Well, the Kilauea CERT team has a canine search and rescue person on it. We've also got a nurse, a very experienced nurse, who is also in the Kauai Medical Reserve Corps. We have a couple of nursing students. Mm-hmm. And so it's a natural opportunity to utilize and take advantage of resources that are there. Contractors, welders, plumbers, electricians, all people who have skills that can come into play in an emergency situation. For CERT, the question is knowing who they are and where they are and how to get a hold of them.
Yeah, that's what I call resource mapping. And fortunately, like in that particular community that I live in also, our doctors live in the very same community in walking distance from their clinics. So that's a strong piece. You are listening to KKCR, Hanalei KAQA Kilauea. This is Felicia and Marshall with Kauai Soapbox. Right now we are talking with the Community Emergency Response Team about keeping Kauai safe and keeping our people safe. And coming up later in the hour, we are going to be shifting dialogues to the joint fact-finding study that has to do with pesticide and what the government has looked at this on. Greg, you're sitting there so quietly, I really need to pull you in.
Well, I was just going to say that I think what John had mentioned earlier about as long as people could be part of the solution and not be part of the problem, that's really how I got involved and why I decided to get involved personally. That plus being able to wear a neon-colored green hat and a vest with orange gloves, I think, is just an outrageous
like
way
Christmas,
to go.
Yeah.
It's superb. Also, you know, when you look at the hours for the commitment, we're talking 24 hours. It's 6 4-hour classes. If you could spare one day, 24 hours out of your life, and you could essentially turn around and help a life, it seems like certainly a worthwhile cause to me. I've practiced even just traffic control. John arranged for us to learn from the police about basic traffic control. Do it correctly so you don't get run over. When you're out here trying to control people coming up from Haena and Waniha from a tsunami and part of the highway is closed, you need to be able to watch out for yourself as well as direct traffic and maintain organized chaos so it doesn't turn into total mayhem.
That's where the orange gloves come in. Orange gloves at night, great for directing traffic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the main reasons you're not going to get killed is people can see your hands, and it's the kind of instinctive, natural part of what the training goes into and gives you that you might not otherwise simply think of.
And what that is, too, you know, for police and fires, that's a force multiplier, you know. That frees the police up to do more important things rather than just directing traffic in a parking lot or something like that. CERTs are always under the supervision of a professional responder, but it's a force multiplier. Like if you have, you know, five people on a fire crew, you've got a captain, an engineer, and three firefighters, you know, the captain's in charge, right? But then you could assign seven CERTs or other people to each one of those other firefighters. So now you've got 7 times 4, you've got 28 people doing a task as opposed to 4.
So here's a simple question.
Yeah.
If your house stays intact, you know, or if you're okay, sometimes staying home is one of the, you know, then you're not out, you're not on the road, you're not creating a problem, or do you want people to go and be someplace where they're going to help, or should they put a sign up on their house that says all good, or, you
yeah.
know, I mean, I don't think you were here for the hurricane,
yeah,
were you?
Right.
Were any of you here for the hurricane?
I was not, no.
So it when you really live through it, it makes you think differently.
Right.
And so that kind of thing actually is valuable. If there's something like a green sheet or a white sheet or something that's hung out on the thing that says, I need help, or if there's something else that's a symbol that says, we're fine.
Right.
Because as people are going through the neighborhoods and they're starting to look, you know, how do you determine who's good, who's not good? You know, that those, to me, I guess I think about it in terms of taking care of the whole community, because it's, everybody gets very, at least here before, selfless. Everybody cares about everybody else, so there's less panic if you know people are fine.
Right, and that's another component is doing neighborhood damage assessment. You know, coming up here on March 23rd, CERT, along with the Kwai Amateur Radio Club, we're going to practice using our ham radios and basically pushing information from different communities into the emergency operating center in Lihue. So that the neighborhood damage assessment is huge. Because the sooner that information can get into the nerve, you know, or the command post, the more they know what's going on in different communities and how they've been affected. So that's a big component.
As far as spreading the word, the one thing I'll say is I've been living here now 5 years full-time, been coming to Kauai many years. I'm still shocked and amazed to know how many people do not know about the Community Emergency Response Team, CERT. And so when I talk about it just in my daily life, I tell people about it and some inquire about it. I might just suggest to your listeners out here that if they are a member of any kind of an organization, the Rotary Club, Lions Club, this and that club, the Orchid Club of Southside, whatever, we'd be glad to come down and talk for a few minutes at their weekly or monthly meeting, not committing to a whole 24 hours, but just come down, talk story about what CERT's about, 10, 15 minutes, answer some questions, and perhaps there might be a few volunteers that want to then join up. John, before the hour ends, I guess we'll give you his phone number and website.
Why don't you give it now, too, since he brought it up?
The best way is just go to kauai.gov/CERT. That's the county web page, and that's the like the CERT page.
Okay, and then what I have found, not everybody has internet.
So then just call.
What number?
645.
Is this you?
Yeah.
645.
Yeah, 0661.
0661.
And that's the CERT phone.
What's John?
That's not me.
Okay, that's the CERT phone.
No, that's not me. Don't call me.
Okay.
Call the CERT phone.
CERT phone.
And then also just if you do have a computer, KFD.
Like Kauai Fire Department?
Yeah. KFD CERT, CERT, at kauai.gov. And that's our email. So that's I think the phone number and the email are probably the best ways if you have a question. And then if you want to sign up for a class, you go to the county webpage.
And on the phone number, I should say, that's not manned 24/7.
No,
so be prepared to leave your name and number, and someone to get back to you within the next 48 hours.
And I want to give a shout out to the county. I'm giving a shout out right now off the cuff about our seat exchange. It went great. Thank you everybody who are coming, including the mayor. He came and helped. The county was there with their big stage. The county is really behind this whole program. So this comes without a charge, because this is basically the county's ability to have a force multiplier to help them with their community, what do you call ICS or IS? What is that?
The incident command system.
Incident command system. So it helps them. So it's all funded underneath that. So when people come, it's just their time.
Just your time.
And it sounds like it's a huge win-win for both parties, because especially for the person who takes the training, because they are prepared for all kinds of things that they might encounter, even like stopping at a car accident.
Am I right that it's actually funded by FEMA?
Yeah, yeah. The funding comes from FEMA. CERT's part of Citizen Corps, you know, like NOAA, Civil Air Patrol, Red Cross. There's a lot of different organizations that fall under Citizen Corps that's basically all focused on community resilience. So, FEMA funds it. There's really not many funds at all coming through Citizen Corps anymore, so our funding comes from...
The Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Yeah.
And has that funding actually increased in recent years?
Well, after 9/11, it increased quite a bit. But at this point in time, it's diminished again. The grant funds that we get have diminished. But it's enough to operate with, So, we take what we can get. All the money now comes through Homeland Security. There's really no grant funds in Citizen Corps anymore, so it's all Homeland Security monies that are, doing this. And the whole thing, again, is like, the more we can teach communities to take care of themselves, then it just makes stronger communities.
And it seems like partners like the Kilauea Neighborhood Association or different town community associations, or even I want to give a shout out to the Latter-day Saints Church.
Absolutely.
Because the LDS Church or Latter-day Saints, this is almost part of their core curriculum without partnering with the government. Is that correct?
Sure, yeah. We just did a class with them. It's probably a little less than a year ago. But, they're a really supportive organization. And we're hoping to do another class with them as well because they're, it's intricate in their faith. And they're very, very supportive.
I think if you could walk away from, just take one takeaway from any of these trainings and it would benefit you and your family members alone, you've done a big service. Like you had mentioned, Felicia, about an auto accident, which I came upon one about a year ago, and it was basically just some of the crowd control and the traffic control that helped ease the situation. It was right here in Kalio Highway by the Church of the Pacific. It was a total nightmare, and at night. But it was some of those things that I had picked up at the class that allowed me the confidence to park my car, get out there, and get involved in slowing the traffic down so we didn't have multiple mayhem taking place there.
Yeah, again, and that's something I got to mention. That's awesome. I mean, you're always encouraged to help out. One of the things we teach CERTs is to always... Only work within the scope of your training. You can't do anything that is out of the scope of your training or you're freelancing and then you're not covered by the county. So one of the important things that we really have to emphasize with CERTs is you're not allowed to self-activate. You're not allowed to put on any CERT uniform or anything like that at a car accident or if there's a fire in the neighborhood. You have to be activated by civil defense in order to participate.
It doesn't mean you can't help somebody. You're not under the insurance.
If you know first aid and you know CPR, you can do anything you want on your own accord. If you're an electrician and you can turn off the power, you can do that. But if you're you have to be activated by civil defense in order to kind of put on your CERT uniform. And then after that, we really emphasize with everybody, you have to work within the scope of your training. It's like as firefighters, we have limited medical training. We can't do a tracheotomy on somebody. That's gross negligence. We're going to lose our job and get sued. Same thing for CERTs. There's some very important skills that you're learning, but you have to work within the scope of that training.
Still say, here's the educator in me. It increases general competence.
Absolutely.
Of the population. Yeah. And the more competent we are, and I think like when I talk to Kupuna and people, from my grandparents' generation,
sure.
They're so capable. It's shaming.
Yeah.
They can do almost anything, and we are close to helpless if it doesn't take a pen or a button to push.
Yeah, the skills are there and you can use those skills. There is a Good Samaritan law, that says as long as you're not doing something grossly negligent, you can help people any way you can, But even for me, like in the fire department, I can't just, I hear about a structure fire, I go put on my uniform and show up to work. No one called me. They didn't.
Right.
That's the whole thing is like no freelancing. That's one of the things that we really emphasize. But again, going back to skills, they're there, first aid skills, you can use them anytime you want. You know?
So you have a class underway right now in Princeville. There's like 3 more weeks to it. Is that correct?
Uh-huh. Tomorrow night is the fourth class.
We're going
into the second half.
Then tonight you have one in Kilauea.
Starting at 5:30.
Starting at 5:30. So it already started. No, it didn't. Started at 5:30.
The first class.
The first class.
For Kilauea.
For Kilauea. So,
Kilauea Neighborhood Center.
Yeah. And can somebody just show up?
Sure. Yeah. I was going to even say, you know, if the classes are modular because people have busy lives. So, you know, if you have to miss one class, don't let that stop you from doing the classes because you can always make up that class in another community.
And so, then Lihue, which is the Monday night classes, when does that start? Do you have the date?
That starts on the 28th, I think. Is it the 28th?
That's right, March 28th.
March 28th, and those are going to be on Tuesdays?
Mondays.
Mondays.
Yeah, Mondays.
Lihue
okay,
is Monday.
Right.
Yeah,
Lihue
Mondays
is Monday. So I'm paying attention. And then, but what about the west side, the south side? Those have they recently had them, or are they going to have them?
You know what? We're working on that right now. We're trying to find a West Side coordinator.
Okay.
So someone that's doing kind of what I'm doing, but for the whole West Side. So
I'm putting that shout out. If somebody on the West Side has been inspired by this and they're interested, they could call 645-0661, or they could send an email to KFD, like Kauai Fire Department, CERT, like Community Emergency Response Training, KFDCERT at kauai.gov. And so if we get you a crew from the west or the south side, the show's been worth it.
Yeah, I mean, we're here to serve you. The whole program is about the communities and those people. It's not our show.
I'm saying this. The reason that I'm taking the time to have you guys here is because I get how important this is.
Yeah.
And you know, it's not just a hurricane or a tidal wave. I remember we had a terrible storm.
Flooding, too.
We had a terrible storm, and we had the road broke in 7 places. Yeah. And it took, you know, a couple weeks to really fix it. I'm probably exaggerating a little bit, but not much, actually. We had a sinkhole, and we had people die. We had all kinds of things going on. And it's just really important to be regionally competent. And I think we're pretty good at that, but a thing that we have that's a little bit of a challenge is we have a lot of people who don't live here, that are here, that don't have this kind of training, so we have to have extra aloha to be guiding people in a situation that they have no experience with and they don't know what they're doing. So there's a lot of responsibilities for our community, and I'm really, really happy, and one of Kauai Community Radio's core principles is to be a point of safety for, you know, the whole island, but like definitely the North and the East Corridor. That's why the federal government puts any money into this. Mostly we are community supported, but we do have some federal monies that keep our emergency services going on here.
You know, I just want to mention that the American Red Cross is also an important organization.
It's huge.
And they are right now currently recruiting volunteers. And, you know, they respond in times of larger disasters, opening shelters, but also on a more ongoing basis. They respond to house fires and such things as that. So that's another option if you want to get involved in serving the community.
Absolutely. We encourage all of our CERT members to also work with the American Red Cross and or Kauai Medical Reserve Corps. So a lot of the people are actually trained in both.
And the Kauai Amateur Radio Club
and
as well, cross-training with the ham radio.
And that's part of all three of them.
And how about the pilot, what's the pilot program again? The
Civil Air Patrol.
Civil Air Patrol, that's pretty amazing too.
Yeah.
John is too modest. It needs to be known that in Kilauea, for example, John is making sure that we get all of the various agencies that would coordinate together, Red Cross, CERT, Medical Reserve Corps. He's moving us into a much more regularized and structured dialogue with one another so that we can coordinate what each organization is doing and what what part of the whole each of us is. And that's something he's put together in the last couple of months, and it's extremely valuable for those of us in Kilauea, and I'm sure everywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
It's just pre-planning, you know, just plan if we're all going to show up in the same location, how can we support each other, and how can we, like, you know.
And you know, as somebody who isn't as big and strong as the rest of the people in the show here, there's still a lot of value for people like me, because still, even just things like making sure the medicine gets out to wherever, even if that's not in your program yet, that's still a need.
That's Kauai Medical Reserve Corps right there.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Kauai Medical Reserve Corps. So
absolutely.
Maybe we should bring them in when we bring in the Red Cross, because that would be probably a very good way to map and know what is needed. It seems like it could be something that could, well, maybe it's too much private personal information, but that should be on some sort of database somewhere.
Yeah.
And in a hard copy, because if all the power's gone, all
it's
the power's
a little tricky
gone.
In communities, because you have the HIPAA laws, so you can't really just go out and say, "Hey, give us all your medical history and things."
But people
like
could
that,
volunteer;
so.
They could sign up, and they can say, and I think that all that is really important. And other thing is our kupuna, you know, our seniors, and then we have people with special needs and disabilities. I know that, like, I could be corrected by a listener, but at Kalihiwai, when there was a tidal wave, somebody with special needs was not able to evacuate, and my understanding is some other members of the family stayed with them, and they all got hit and taken out together.
Oh.
So, you know, there's really powerful stories, and I know, like, today I was at the planning hearing. That was tough. Oh, boy. But some of this was about what's in Hyena, and we see all these houses 16, 18 feet in the air because there's been tidal waves. I think whoever came up with that policy doesn't windsurf. You know, I look at that and I think, well, there's a certain intuitive piece of physics that's maybe not being paid attention to, but
can
who
you
knows?
Explain that, Felicia?
Because if you just barely lift your sail off the water by about 4 inches, you can handle it. You need to get underneath and hook in before you start to lift it up further, because you can get lifted out. So the higher you bring your sail off the surface of the water, the more force, the more effort, it's going to fly. So I remember when I started watching all these big, like, daddy long leg type of housing being built, I'm thinking, oh, there's a bunch of kites. That's how it looks to me, you know. So sometimes I sit there and wonder. I'm not on that team that made that, you know, and maybe they're right. I mean, I'd like to think that they're right, but it's never been tested.
Yeah.
So if you're in the low-lying areas and there's a big storm, get out of them, right? Go up high. And here's, I'm throwing this out in case anybody from the county is listening, or civil defense, they might be listening. Our only shelter right now is the Kilauea Neighborhood Association, which probably has a crammed capacity of
70.
Okay, 70. All right. So it's small. That's supposed to be the entire North Shore.
Yeah.
So the saying, you know, 7,000 people. And I don't know if the hotels want to take people again, but all those things, they say they don't. I bet they will. But when people were in the hotel here in Princeville, it was said to be, you know, felt like the Poseidon Adventure or something, because the water tanks from the top were all breaking, the glass was breaking, you know, a lot of screaming and running into the halls. People need to take it seriously, and especially whether people believe in climate change or don't believe in climate change, we can believe that the climate is changing for whatever reason it's changing. I've got the range of people listening, but around the world, there has been more powerful storms. So, anyway, I want to allow you guys each a final thought. I'm going to keep Alan in here for the next one, but you guys need to get safely out before you're locked in here when the gate closes at 5. So, Greg?
I guess my final thought is that if anybody is ever concerned about, or interested, thought about giving back, finding out a way to help their community, let alone their family, this is a great way to be self-serving as well as community-serving. Contact some of the website and the phone number that John had mentioned earlier and get involved. If you never use the knowledge, that's better for you. But
it's
if you have a chance to use it, you know, one life saved or somebody helped is certainly worthwhile, that's for sure.
Thank you very much. And John?
Well, I would just, you know, hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. And, you know, the, as far as the CERT program is concerned, you know, we're here to serve you. So you don't have to wait for classes to pop up. If you in a business or organization of any way, you know, shape or form, if you want a class, we'll put one together for you. And, you know, just get involved, you know, be a part of the solution instead of part of the problem.
Okay, and that's 645-0611. I see that I have a phone call. Let's see if it's a quick call for you gentlemen before you walk out the door. And, okay, it's not going to be. So thank you so much for what you've done, and thank you, Big Mahalo, to the fire department in general. They've been doing great work, and I want to even, not even, but also Mahalo the police department, because we had a big drug bust, that was a good thing, and then we had like a safe, no one got hurt when the bank was robbed, and that was sequestered. So we're seeing good progress happening, and I just want to acknowledge the county for doing a good job. Is this for these guys?
Felicia, we just had a listener who'd like to know the location of the Kilauea Community Center, because she'd like to attend tonight.
Okay, it's right where the gym is, so if you go down Kilauea Road and you turn right on Kaneke Street?
Yeah, yes. It's where the bus stop is.
Yeah, where the bus stop is there, and so...
Look for the gym.
Oops. Look for the gym. You can think of the bakery, that area too. So, all right. So thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, Felicia. Thank you.
Okay, and Marshall... you
yes.
had somebody who was, I was thinking about too many things, and I said 1969, it was 1968 that there was some drama in Chicago over the, do you remember it, Alan? You're probably
yes.
old enough to remember it. I remember it because of the rioting. I was six and I saw it. You know?
I was in Army basic training when that happened. I remember it vividly.
Were you there?
No,
okay.
We were at Fort Dix, New Jersey, and so we all listened to it on radio. It was a very, very spooky time.
And what had happened was that Robert Kennedy had been killed.
Correct.
Martin Luther King had been killed, and Robert Kennedy was somebody who was running for president.
Right, and the nominee turned out to be Hubert Humphrey, who was a nominee of very little popularity, not prepared for what was going to be asked of him, adamantly opposed by a great portion of the population, and it all boiled over in Chicago when Mayor Richard Daley, the original Mayor Richard Daley, not
the junior,
not to be confused with his
son.
The mayor at one point ordered the police to shoot to kill or maim and cripple protesters.
Oh,
it was grim.
That sounds grim. I remember them turning cars over and things like that. I do remember things like that. So why I just had brought that up is that there are, you know, this is kind of a tough race that's going for the presidential. We have some aggression in some of the candidates. It seems a little bit troublesome, and I think that there's so much passion. People either want or vividly don't want the candidate that they're in favor of. Marshall, today there was a bunch of primaries, I think Florida, Ohio,
Illinois, Missouri, and North Carolina.
Okay.
Rubio's out. Rubio lost Florida to Trump, and he's now out of the campaign. So it's down to, and Kasich won Ohio, so it's now down to Kasich, Trump, and Cruz.
Okay. And so are you looking at the results?
I am.
And are they incomplete, or are they still counting?
Missouri has 68% reporting, so they haven't officially called that yet. The rest of the Republican primaries for today have been called, and
the winner is,
as you say, Alan, Ohio has been won by Kasich, and the rest have gone to Trump. So yes, if Donald Trump had won Florida and Ohio, that would have fairly well assured that he would have a majority of delegates going into the convention, and a contested convention wouldn't have been possible.
Well, it may still turn out to be that way, too. He, I'm sure, will say that tomorrow,
right,
that he's locked the nomination up. On the Democratic side, when I left to come over here, Clinton was either called or leading in Florida, Illinois.
Illinois, yes. She leads in Illinois. She has won North Carolina. She has won Ohio. And in Missouri, with 71% reporting, Sanders does lead 50% to 48%.
And what about Ohio?
Ohio has been won by Clinton.
So she got four of the five?
She got four of the five. And that's difficult for Bernie Sanders. He really thought he was going to win Ohio. So.
And are they close, or are they big variances? Because correct me if I'm wrong, but in the Democrat delegate distribution, it goes percentage in every state?
That's the Republicans, as I understand it, are winner-take-all today. The Democratic primaries are proportional, I believe, unless Florida changed a lot, but 90% were in when I came over here. She killed him in Florida.
Yeah, let me flip it up. Florida, Hillary Clinton got 64% of the vote. Yeah, so she gained 122 delegates to Bernie Sanders' 60 in Florida alone. And, yeah, today the Republican primaries in Ohio and Florida were winner-take-all. From today on, some are and some aren't.
Well, where that puts us, and I've had, I don't know where, how far we want to go with this kind of analysis, but I've had many conversations with friends who support Bernie Sanders, who seem unwilling to support Hillary Clinton. And my concern here is if we have either of the two likely, most likely Republican nominees, Trump or Cruz, do you want either of them more than you want Hillary Clinton? And if you don't, you need to get over Bernie Sanders.
Okay, we can't do any kind of calls to action. That's his opinion.
That's true.
It's his opinion. So this is community radio, so we have certain tethers on us.
But I think you're right. Sanders was looking to stay much closer today than he apparently has. So there's going to be a lot of speculation tomorrow about what that now means for the Democratic process,
right?
As in Democratic Party.
Yeah, it's not over, but boy, today makes it a lot tougher on Bernie Sanders.
And it, you know, when I look, and I'm asking, but when I look at how much Trump has had a landslide for the most part across the country, do you have a cumulative percentage that he is the top leader? Like, I guess when I was thinking about the 1968 thing in Chicago, the convention in Chicago, and that was played on the song that we were listening to. They were speaking about all those murders that had happened in that time. Would it be a problem like that? I mean, I think that people, we're seeing rather aggressive behavior to support him. And I think that they wouldn't be taken well if a decision is to not have him be that. What percentage of the delegates does he have?
Well, I'm not looking at percent, but of the 1,237 that are needed to secure the nomination, Donald Trump currently has 619.
But it's worth remembering, though, that Trump has not yet. Now, this may change with Rubio out after today, but unless one of the primaries today gave Trump more than 50%, he has yet to win a majority of Republican votes in a Republican primary. I think people have lost sight of that. It's the situation is going to tighten and get way more complicated now with Rubio out, and if it looks like it's a Cruz on Trump, and if the speculation about Kasich that he would, if he won Ohio, he was in for the duration, that may turn out to be true. It's going to be a very much more complicated situation on the Republican side than it has been up to today.
Why do you think he would stay in, John Kasich?
I think Kasich, well, for one thing, it's clear that the so-called Republican establishment would probably prefer that he be the nominee.
Right.
So they would like to keep him in the race, would be, that's my guess.
Right.
He also seems to be a man who very passionately believes that these other two guys are nuts, and that there still needs to be a rational alternative among the Republican candidates. I don't know the man. I've never met him, just have no acquaintance with him at all. It seems clear he's the most rational of the three of them.
He's certainly popular at home.
And he won his state, which Rubio was unable to do.
Right.
Big difference.
Right.
So you are listening to KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea. This is Felicia and Marshall with Kauai Soapbox. Alan Parkini is in the studio with us. We are shortly to go to discussing the joint fact-finding study regarding the pesticides. In the meantime, Kauai Soapbox is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with the Copper Man.
KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, K224CQ, Anahola, K284AL, Haleiwa.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KKCR, its board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
The Copper Man. Copper, stainless steel, and galvanized aluminum. We specialize in ornamental and custom work and fabricate and install any kind sheet metal work, residential and commercial. Serving Kauai for over 30 years. We're still talking. HarryConti.com. That's HarryConti.com or 639-3456.
And mahalo for listening to Kauai Community Radio. So you, Marshall, were telling me that Donald has like about 6,000 votes. What is Ted?
I'm sorry,
600.
Right.
You said 690?
619.
I care about this. I normally don't care about the presidential stuff because it just doesn't seem to matter, but this one does matter. And then Ted Cruz, where was he at?
He's got 394.
And then John Kasich?
He's got 136. And Marco Rubio, irrelevant, but 167.
So...
Do we know what happens to Rubio delegates?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you.
I have no idea.
Okay. You're supposed to know everything.
Yeah, right?
Don't know.
Okay, well, Okay, so we're kind of looking at that. And then how much delegates does Hillary have? How much delegates does Bernie have?
All right, sorry. I went to looking up that question.
Okay.
Primary results. How many delegates do they have? Okay. Hillary Clinton now has 1,021 pledged delegates.
That includes today's result?
Yes. Okay. And
she has how many?
1,021. And, that includes the results that are final today.
But not superdelegates.
Right. And then she's got 467 superdelegates for a total of 1,488 of the 2,383 needed for the nomination. There are 2,573 still available. So it's, you know, there's plenty of race ahead for those two. Bernie Sanders currently has 678 pledged delegates, and he does have 26 superdelegates.
So that's good. Well, I'm actually going to try and see if I can get him to come on the show next week. It's sort of a long shot. I sent something out to both Bernie and Hillary.
Now, have you invited Trump?
thank you for reminding me of that. I will send something out.
Sure. Just a little courtesy.
I have to send one to all of them. When we're talking about federal politics, I notice what's nicknamed the Dark Act is in the Senate today in Congress. And that, you know, I don't feel good about any industry being able to hide the contents of the food. That has to do with GMO labeling. And I don't like that it has a piece in there to ensure that it goes into schools to say that it is fine. And so to me, that is conditioning our citizens. It's a little bit of brainwashing. There's a little tiny piece of my opinion there. I don't know if you guys have an opinion on that. I can't say what people should do, but I know that I don't support that structure of what is called the Dark Act. Gary Hooser just came in.
Hello.
Hi, Gary. Do you know about that Senate bill in the House that they're calling the Dark Act? Do you know what the real number of it is? They're not calling it the Dark Act. Right?
I do not know the number. I've heard about discussion, but I don't know the number.
It has a very long name, and it's become known as Dark Act. It's not Dark is not the acronym for it. It's just a term of art that's been coined.
Okay. So I want to talk about the joint fact-finding study, and I thank you both for being in here. Alan, I read that you had something in the paper, and Gary, I read you had a pretty strong blog on it, and I am going to have a little bit of editorial license here, and I'm going to start with saying what my read was on it. I read it too, and then I want to let you guys really be able to build in that. But when I read it, to me, it seemed largely in agreement with the 2491 movement, which was the people who are saying, hey, we want to know what they're spraying. We don't have enough information. We should know that there's not enough study out there to know of how people are being hurt by it, what's going on. So it was asking for that, and it was saying these pesticides have serious implications. And there are little bits and pieces of evidence that the pesticides are making it off the property. So when I read the joint fact-finding study, and I will let you guys go a little bit deeper into it, but I felt that it was calling that out, and I was pleased to see that there were 13 recommendations that I think would be making Kauai safer, and if it was applied across the islands, it would make all the islands safer. And to me, if these guys are working within the label and it is working the way it is, they don't have a problem, because then we will be able to see, hey, there's no problem. But I felt that the study was kind of weak, and they claimed that they were weak because they didn't go out and really do some tests and they didn't do anything further. So it did straight up say in there that they can't prove that all this damage was happening because it's not really being checked, is the way I read it.
Insufficient data.
Insufficient data. So I think I want to let Gary talk first, because he just walked in the door, and you've been on the show for an hour.
Thank you, Felicia. Thank you to KKCR. You know, I want to, first of all, applaud the participants in the joint fact-finding group. They've worked really, really hard for over a year. Peter Adler leading the charge, and most of the group are volunteers, and they work really, really hard, strictly as volunteers, to put this information together. When it was first created, it was applauded by the mayor, Mayor Carvalho, by the Department of Agriculture, by the industry, and by many in the community as a good step forward, and was said to be, or intended to be, an independent and neutral look at existing data. And so I just want to get that out right away, that, you know, I applaud the people that worked so hard on this report.
And of the people who worked so hard on it, it wasn't like they were all, there was a range of people. There were people who were considered friends of the industry and people who maybe were part of the team that was concerned. So the goal was a balance across it. Would you agree with that, Alan?
Yes. There were two industry employed people on the task force. Originally, there were nine. One of them dropped out toward the end, so it ended up with eight. But I think it could fairly be described as a balanced panel.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's only two people there, if I remember correctly, that testified in support of Bill 2491 in terms of that side of the issue.
I would say that's correct. And one of them was a doctor and of really profound capacity. He at one point ran Kauai Medical Clinic.
That's right. That's right.
When this study was initiated, was there commitment on anyone's part to actually follow the recommendations?
You know, I don't know if that was true or not. I just thinking back, it seems like the report was a gathering of information, and I'm not clear if I even knew there was going to be recommendations. I'm very pleased with the recommendations they made. Number one, they acknowledged the lack of data And when we did 2491 way back, that's we acknowledged that too, and said we need data, and we need to get it through disclosure, and then we need to do a study. At that time, it was an EIS.
And for clarity, the people driving down the road that maybe moved here last month or don't know what we're talking about, 2491 was a bill that you initiated that was asking for disclosure of the restricted-use pesticides or the most dangerous pesticides. Actually asked for all of them, the general use as well, but it eventually got passed with the restricted use, and then to have buffer zones around schools, hospitals, and houses.
And then it called for a study as well. And it was aimed toward the largest users of these chemicals. And so the results that came out, the recommendations, the one, I don't know if it's number one or not, but they recommend mandatory disclosure, expanding the Good Neighbor Program, and including general use pesticides. I'm very pleased to see that. They recommended aggressive testing of soil, water, air. They recommend looking closely at buffer zones. And there's just a lot of recommendations they make, acknowledging that there's insufficient data and there's sufficient cause for concern. An issue that's been debated hotly is the issue of chronic exposure as opposed to acute exposure. Chronic exposure, to put it simply, is small exposure over time. And one of the recommendations was to ask the State Department of Agriculture to look at lowering those exposure levels, because recognizing that just because something is below a federal or a California guideline, if you're exposed to that chemical day after day for 30 years or for long periods of time, there could be harmful health impacts.
And through young childhood, right, particularly, especially when it's like right next to a school or something of that effect.
That's right.
So can you tell us what the recommendations are? I can pull it up if you would like me to, because I do have it loaded on my computer.
I've got it.
You know, I...
Okay, Marshall, do you want to just say a few of them? Like actually, let's say them, because... That's the facts of what came out. It's not an opinion. That's the facts of what came out of this joint fact-finding study.
Right.
There are also findings as to what's been proven and what hasn't. Mr. Hooser go a little bit farther in.
I'll have you speak to the pieces that support your aspect. And but I'm gonna give Gary this piece here, because I think it is really important. And if I were to be throwing out some of my biases, they were going into the joint fact-finding study, I was skeptical. I was thinking, this is going to be a complete give to the industry, and it is going to be another opportunity. It's going to be another opportunity to just validate what's happened, but they really didn't come up with that. So,
right. And I have a summary of the recommendations. And first recommendation was for the governor to take leadership, governor of the state of Hawaii, to take leadership on this issue and to ask for $3 million working with the state legislators of Kauai. $3 million to implement the studies. Establishment for chronicity, that's that chronic exposure component.
Meaning day in and day out, you're breathing it at night.
I've got the page numbers here. I don't need to read those on the air. Mandatory disclosure by large users. We talked about that already. Establishing a consistent buffer zone policy and use green screens. Ensure drift monitoring. Particularly downwind of high-volume application areas around schools, towns, and public facilities. We've been talking about this for the last couple of years. Require the Department of Water to test and monitor for chlorpyrifos. And this is especially important to me, because I've actually asked in writing the Department of Water, do you test for chlorpyrifos? And if not, would you consider doing so? And they told me that no, they don't test, and no, they would not consider doing so. I then sent them the information from the EPA, which specifically calls out the use of chlorpyrifos around corn and in places with small watershed areas. And they still said, no, we're not going to test. And now I'm pleased to see this recommendation in there that, that they will test. And then implement a systematic pilot program that tests west side air, soil, and dust for pesticides in areas adjacent to the seed company operations. Again, there's been a lot of talk about dust in soil, but there's been no testing of any significance. And that's my summary. And I know there's a whole bunch of other ones, but we could...
Well, there are a whole bunch of other ones. And I want to at least acknowledge that the depth of who all made recommendations, like the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, right, said, hey, let's test the waters that's going into the salt ponds.
Actually, I'm not clear that the Department of Hawaiian Homelands made that recommendation, but that was a recommendation that group made to them,
okay,
as well as the Department of Education, to test the air at Waimea Canyon School specifically. I believe the group made the recommendations to the agency.
Well, I'm seeing that the governor made a recommendation.
The panel made recommendations to various
levels the panel's of government. Making the oh, yeah, they're correct. Not making the correct. Okay, all right, that's a big difference. Okay,
and
all right, I had that wrong.
So other recommendations include adding pesticide inspectors and reducing delays in inspections. No one can argue with that. Enforcing existing labeling laws. Establishing an apiary monitoring program.
That's bees.
Mandatory medical checks of workers who are employed in situations where they're exposed to pesticide. Initiate a user fee on pesticide sales, improve the Department of Agriculture's geographic systems. I'm not quite sure I know what that means.
Well, so that they can tell where everything is all mapped out.
Right. And then there are two for Kauai County. I'll get into that in a few minutes.
So when I looked at this, this was at least as strong, if not stronger, than what was asked for by the council. I mean, what the community asked for of Gary was much bigger than, you know, Gary narrowed it down, the council narrowed it down, and this is bigger than what was passed.
It's much broader and much more aggressive.
So that was a surprise. Now, I read, Alan, your article in the paper,
right,
and you interpreted it totally differently. You interpreted it as, hey, you know, kind of in agreement with the pesticide companies saying it's all good, that it's... there's no evidence of harm.
I wouldn't go that far.
Okay.
I didn't say it's all good.
I felt that you said, hey, it's in agreement with what the pesticide company, or the companies who use the pesticide.
There are three pivotal findings that the panel makes that are very important given the history of Bill 2491. And let's remember that Bill 2491 was originally offered as an anti-GMO and anti-pesticide bill. Yes, it was.
As the author of the bill, I would dispute that statement, but I'm not going to interrupt you and let you continue.
And as somebody who was in the meetings, when people wanted it to be an anti-GMO bill, Gary, that's where he shut everybody down, is saying, let's look at the pesticides. Let's look at the pesticides, because because I was in those meetings, and that is what I heard from
Gary.
The
GMO provisions of the bill were amended out in the council, but as originally conceived, it was an anti-GMO and anti-pesticide bill.
The bill never banned pesticides or GMOs. The bill asked for disclosure and... no open-air testing of regulated crops, but it allowed, yeah. So, again, I'll argue with the characterization of the bill.
Okay, but, all right. In its persona as an anti-pesticide or a pesticide bill, the 2491 made a number of assumptions that should have awaited the kind of review that the Joint Fact-Finding Group did. What the Joint Fact-Finding Group did with public funds exclusively, $100,000 of all of our money, and I think it's important to emphasize on the group's behalf that they were never asked to do original research. The amount of money they had available to them to do their work would never have supported any kind of original research. They were empowered, and they did succeed in identifying areas where additional research is is necessary. The three big ticket findings to me, although it's all based on what evidence there is out there, but they are, there is no evidence of untoward health effects relating to pesticides on Kauai. There is no evidence of cancer rates being affected by pesticides on Kauai. There is no evidence of birth defects being precipitated by pesticides on Kauai.
Because they look at the whole island. They're not
They look at what data is available or are available.
Right. So it doesn't concentrate it for that area.
Well, the group did what it did, and I think they did this very carefully. Now, to me, the better approach, and I've been saying this for a couple of years, the better approach for Mr. Husser would have been to await the kind of review that the Joint Fact-Finding Group has done before introducing a bill that was based on assumptions that have now turned out to be unsupported by the available evidence.
So I want to just jump in here, and I want to let Gary say it too, but like a lot of this started coming up on the radio, this radio show, and the marches got incubated and first articulated on this radio show. So I was right there at the nexus of when these decisions were being made and seeing who was mobilizing it. And these were the young people. It was the young generation, and they were furious. And so Gary is often said, oh, this was all about him, and he should have waited. He was simply responding to a mobilized group of people who were dominantly parents of young children. I would say that was the belly band of it. And then grandmothers, but really these young people who were like upset that their kids were having heart problems and having problems. And so there was a fury that was out there. And Gary tried to say, okay, well, we can look at the pesticides and we can just look at where the range goes and have them tell us, and we'll put buffer zones around. Many people were still very, very unhappy with how limited that was, and that's why coming right behind it there was this ballot initiative, because people were like, well, we don't want to be told what we're being sprayed with. Yes, we need to know that, but we want the spraying to stop. So to be suggesting that he did a mistake by not, I don't mean to be protecting you, but this is just my truth. I want to just say this, is to say that this was him being reckless. You weren't there for those meetings, and this was him calming a revolt.
If I could just a little bit of history, I think it's important. Thank you, Felicia. You characterized it correctly. When I was elected to the council, going around the island, people would come to me and they were concerned about this issue. They're concerned about pesticides. They're concerned about GMOs. They're concerned about health impacts. And so I began asking questions, and I asked the industry, help me figure this out. You know, what are you guys using? What are you spraying? What pesticides? And they would not tell me. And then it became clear to me that I couldn't do research. We can't do a study without disclosure. We can't study impacts of anything unless we know what's being used. And so I began working with Tim Bynum, Councilmember Bynum, and the community, putting together a very basic bill that called for disclosure, and then it called for buffer zones around sensitive areas and a study. And initially, it had a temporary moratorium, and that was it. Oh, and banning of open-air testing was in the beginning. But it was intended to take some basic precautions. When that bill was introduced, I had no idea that there were claims of birth defects in the community. I did not know the doctors that made those claims, and the same with the cancer. I knew people were concerned, but I had no idea of the depth of that concern. And when I got an email from two physicians who work at KVMH, who they said flat out, we're not scientists, we haven't done peer-reviewed research, but we've been delivering babies in this community for 8 years, and we believe, based on our information, that we have 10 times the rate of heart defects in newborns, that I was flabbergasted. And that's enough evidence for me to move forward with buffer zones and whatnot. But I did not know those doctors. I didn't ask them to testify. And if you ask those doctors today, they will tell you that they believe that the gaps in the data with regard to heart defects and birth defects in general are very huge.
And intentional I mean, the gaps, but a lot of these babies are born on Oahu and different things like that.
But these physicians, and these are, I tell people, it's not my North Shore doctor friends. These are, you know, West Side doctors delivering babies who believe in their hearts and in professionally that there's some issues here. They were right up front. They said, we don't know if it's a random cluster or if it's caused by GMOs or pesticide, but we believe it's a problem. And they question this data. And just, if I can read from the report, just one sentence or two. The report states, and Alan is correct, they say that it does not show current pesticide use plays an adverse health role on Kauai. It does say that. But it precedes that sentence because of the small populations involved and the lack of fully reliable and accurate health data.
Right.
The information they had doesn't prove that there's harm. So they say right up front, we don't have the data to prove that there's harm, but we're concerned, and they need more data.
And what I watched, and I think is an important part of this story, especially for people who, you know, people come and they don't even know what happened. We had a particular very charismatic person, Dustin Barca, whose children got healthier once they stopped eating these foods. And he was mobilized. And
he says his children got healthier.
That was his experience.
It's what he says.
It's what, well, right. I mean, okay. So we have a charismatic individual who was a good spark, along with Fern, Holland Rosensteel, and there was two others, Eli and Haley, began something very, very quickly. It was in the middle of February. They said, let's do a march in March. It was Dustin who said that, and I'm thinking, how are you going to be able to do that? And the five Saturdays of that march on five islands, big mobilization of people, a couple thousand people here. We had almost double that in a march later on. This was so much bigger than a council member, and what did happen, because I was spending the night out on the in the rain, you know, all this stuff that went on, it pretty much took over a whole year of council work. The
yes,
meetings were over and
yes,
over again. And the people that were demanding that, they don't understand everything else that the council needs to do. This was desperate parents of young children, and they were not going to take no for an
answer.
And
what happened, unfortunately, is that their fear ended up being exploited because But I think there was some political exploitation that went on here. Let's take one particular birth defect, gastroschisis.
Okay, that was on the North Shore. That was not him doing that, though. So we had a North Shore person, and I was calling that out all the time, that child was not.
You know, I think we'd be better served to look forward.
Yes, okay.
You know, we're here to talk about the joint fact-finding, and I will be the first to admit that if we look back, we could have done some things differently.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, the conclusions we came to are the same conclusion the Joint Fact-Finding Committee came to. And
pretty
I think
much.
We want to look forward
okay.
on that.
Okay, thank you. So you're listening to KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea. This is Felicia and Marshall with Kauai Soapbox. I have Alan Parakini in the studio with me and Council Member Gary Hooser. So, yes, looking forward, what do we do now? This is a comment period, and so I read through that, and I just had my parade rained on. I didn't read it well enough to see that this was the recommendation that joint fact-finding people are saying to these 13 entities, not them kind of backing
one,
us up.
One thing to pay attention to in the recommendations is that there's a host of them. Many of them are very good recommendations. Only two of them are directed at Kauai County. And that is where this approach legislatively ran off the rails, I think. It was based on the premise that the county had the ability to take independent action on pesticide issues, when all along the more productive approach would have been to work within existing rules and laws on the books. So the Joint Fact-Finding Committee comes along and points out that there really isn't much of a role here for the county specifically to take. And if I've said for all along that we would have been much better off if we had addressed the issue of elimination of pesticide inspector positions, more aggressive enforcement of existing rules and regulations. If we would have accomplished a whole lot more than we have
had we
done that. So going forward, listen to what we should have listened to all along, which is use and make more effective the existing array of resources that can be brought to bear in this field. And also, let's separate fear and paranoia from fact.
And let's throw in frustration, because there's not the political will in Honolulu to do it. People spend hundreds of dollars going over there to testify, and they are ignored. So I want to give it to Gary.
And we would not be here today if not for the community's effort 2 or 3 years ago. Discussing this, we're looking at statewide solutions. We are here today because the community on Kauai felt this was an issue and wanted to move forward with it.
Sorry.
And I have to say, too, today our community, Felicia, and I hope you agree, is a healthier place than it was 3 years ago. There are less, if you look at this report, you look at the amount of pesticides being used. They're using less restricted-use pesticides today than they were 3 years ago. If you drive down the road, you'll see, especially in Lihue, there are not as many fields as close to the roads, and the fields have the voluntary, so-called voluntary disclosure. There's a lot more disclosure than there was. There's a lot more buffer zones than there were. So our community action as a county and as individuals has made our community a safer place.
I want to agree with that, and I want to give a shout-out to the companies, too, where I don't think any of them in there want to hurt the community. I think prior to this becoming such a big issue, they really believed, and maybe they still believe, they're not hurting the community. I don't think that they are evil people, and I think that there is hyper caution now, but I have been going to these meetings. I know, Gary, you were there at one of them for at least part of it, and I met recently with Syngenta and Dow, and Syngenta came on the air, and so we're learning that the market is also part of the impact of this. So China, that was buying the corn seed to feed their chickens and pigs over there as their population's wanting to eat proteins, now they are growing their own corn and they don't need it so much. Another big consumer of this corn was ethanol, and ethanol is still protected by the government, so it has to go in the gas. But at this point, ethanol is more expensive than petroleum. And so if the government protection came off of that, so what's happening is the federal government is protecting the industry, and we're seeing this in the DARK Act right there. And especially if they get to forcefully integrate this awareness into the schools, this mind conditioning of the children. And so, like, what other kind of food gets that kind of protection? And so their gas market is protected. I'm not saying I want them to go out of business. What I want them to do is just grow corn and do it in a healthy way, or grow whatever they need to do, but they can do it without hurting our community. I believe we have a caller, so we're going to take this call quickly. Aloha, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Aloha, is this me?
It is you.
Oh, right on. And I just wanted to throw it out there to Mr. Paratini, his suggestion that on the front end we should have been working with the existing entities to, if you will, oversee and regulate. And that's exactly why it didn't go that way, because for a number of years or a number of sessions, the state house was preventing any type of pesticide registry, any type of legislative action that was generated from concerns from people in the community that the ag representative, the ag committee representative from the Big Island.
Cliff Tsuji?
Biotech. Legislator of the year would prevent any type of meaningful work to get done. And so I applaud that Mr. Hooser and Mr. Bynum and all the other folks that you were just naming off, Felicia, to suggest that there was another avenue to get some type of reasonable legislation to better handle the issue of pesticide drift, the exposure that whether they're elderly or children, whether it's waterborne or it's on the mountainside, you know, there's just valid concerns. And I think the Joint Fact-Finding Group is suggesting that these concerns are valid, and we need to do more than what's currently happened. So thanks for having this conversation on our community radio.
Okay, thank you. So he pulls it right back to the present. So what can we do? So I was all excited that I was reading it thinking, okay, the government is saying, all right, you're right, but they're not. Just these people are sitting in that room are saying, we agree both with what Alan's saying, that there isn't the evidence, but, hey, there needs to be the evidence. Look at it. Give him this chance.
Go ahead. So I think the state government now, and the county government for that matter, and the Department of Water, all the agencies who have been, recommendations have been put forth, are now in a position of denying their own report or following through with the recommendations. So I'm hopeful that the governor and our Kauai state legislators will look at this report that was sponsored by the Department of Agriculture and much applauded by them when it was launched and by the mayor and by many. Look at those recommendations and say, okay, our own agency made these recommendations. We need to start implementing them. It's not just protesters marching on Kauai or whatever. This is an official government report that came to some conclusions and validated the community's concerns. And so I'm hopeful that will happen. The comment period, it's my understanding, is directed at factual information that may be wrong or may be missing from this report.
And my understanding is you can also say, I agree with this, but what they don't want to hear is just more restating of the past, my kid was sick. They don't want the anecdotal stories. They want, if you're saying something is wrong, they want to have it linking to a factual scientific study that says that that's wrong, like if more data can come in. I mean, more links that refute what they have there.
This has been built, this whole process has been built, unfortunately, too much on anecdote and too little on science. And that's we're paying the price for that now. I think it's also worth pointing out that two different federal judges have now said that counties in Hawaii are not empowered to take individual action on pesticides now, and bills in the legislature have failed to that effect for whatever reason.
They're back in court.
They're still in court.
In June, the appeal will be heard. The Ninth Circuit appeal will be heard. I have to say that former Hawaii State Supreme Court Justice, as well as eight other prominent attorneys from around the state, including the chair of the Bar Association, and many, many, total of nine, said that we had a legal basis. And I agree, the federal judge on our case, a federal magistrate judge, felt differently, and we're appealing it. That's part of the process.
And I'm going to let Alan finish, then we're going to take another call.
Well, it is part of the process, and this is likely to remain mired in litigation for some time to come. It's hard to imagine that whoever loses at the Ninth Circuit level is not going to try to take it farther than that, which may bring us into an interesting situation with a Supreme Court one justice shy if the Republicans persist in refusing to even consider a nominee from President Obama to the court. If you think this through, the Roberts Supreme Court has been possibly the most business-friendly Supreme Court in living memory. So the question is always there in litigation, do you really want to roll this dice? How far do you really want to take this? What are you putting at risk? So in a sense, it seems to me that rather than put a lot of confidence in the outcome of a case, or actually I guess it's three cases.
Talking about one case.
Well, but still, the Maui case and the Hawaii County case.
Those were not about pesticides, they're about GMOs. Ours is primarily pesticides.
But they're both also about county powers.
No, but there's totally different powers. The GMO case is about the federal has jurisdiction, pesticide case is about the state having jurisdiction.
Granted.
Totally separate legal arguments.
But you would agree, I assume, that you never know how when you litigate, you never know what's going to happen. It doesn't matter who says who says what about the merits of your case. Just don't know.
I have a caller holding, so I'm going to take that call, and then I'm going to come back to how people can participate. Aloha, thank you for holding here on the air.
Hey, thank you, Felicia and Gary. This is Terry Lilly, and you know, most of you guys know that I'm doing a lot of the underwater research on the coral reefs here in Kauai. And I've been involved in over $20 million worth of funding for studies for underwater research projects. And I just kind of want to validate something that Gary and Felicia are both saying here, that in the last 2 to 3 years that I've worked with the University of Hawaii, USGS, NOAA, and Scripps Institute to do detailed scientific studies on the effects of these pesticide chemicals on our coral reefs here in Kauai. And you know that all of the funding, over $8 million, was offered by NOAA, the head of NOAA Coral Reef Division, to come to Kauai to study this problem. And all of these funds were canceled by the DLNR and our former governor here in Kauai in 2015. So it's no small wonder that there's no available scientific data on the effects of these chemicals to our endangered species, our wetlands, and our coral reefs, because it's obvious that all of the funds have been canceled to do these studies. We're not going to go anywhere with the science on any of this stuff without proper scientific studies. That will show us exactly what's going on here on Kauai with these deadly chemicals. But when all these funds are completely canceled by our own government, we have nowhere to go but just sit here and complain.
And how is it that you know this has occurred?
Because I actually was a part of the funding and writing up all the grants on all of these studies. My work has been viewed by over 20 million people worldwide. I'm working with Obama's, you know, Chief of Staff, Admiral Harris, all the way through to NOAA, National Geographic. If you just want to give me a call later on and you want to look at my resume on how many of these $20 million worth of studies I've done worldwide, I would be happy to share that with you.
I will connect the two of you for that later discussion.
The question, though, is how do you know that any of these funds were canceled, and how do you know what the reason
NOAA,
is?
The head of NOAA, I'll just give you a good example. The head of NOAA, John Christensen, for the Coral Reef Division that reports to Barack Obama in the White House every 30 days, wrote up a grant with me for $8 million to go to the state of Hawaii in 2015 to fund a study here on Kauai to see what's killing our coral reefs. A part of that $8 million grant was to study the effects of pesticides out on the coral reefs here. Now, that money and that check was sent to Governor Abercrombie and William Ayala, the head of the DLNR. That money was dispersed to every island in the Hawaiian Islands. Over $3 million went to Maui. Not one penny went to Kauai, and that was the purpose of the grant that we wrote up.
And you have, you could make available a copy of that grant, I'm sure, and you could make available
the
documentation that establishes that the money was somehow mysteriously intercepted.
Put it this way, I used to teach environmental law, and I am more than willing to show the legal aspect of how all of these funds that we've been working so hard to get to study the die-off of our coral reefs here in Kauai and the destruction of some of our wetlands due to chemicals. And we needed these studies, and they got canceled, and I can connect anyone with the head of these agencies that will tell you that these funds got canceled to Kauai.
And I think it's really clear. This is when you look at the history of the industry, the chemical industry in general, the DuPonts and the Dows and the Monsantos of the world. You look over the years, and it's clear they do not want more disclosure. They do not want people testing and doing independent disclosure. They've done everything they could, in my experience here locally, to prevent people from knowing what they're doing, knowing what they're using,
Gary, listen to this. When you're so correct on that, it's unbelievable. A lot of people don't know, but I had an environmental law teaching company in California, and this was 20 years ago, and people had to take my environmental class to learn about the Endangered Species Act before they could work in the field. Do you know who my two main clients were? Monsanto and the U.S. military. They had to take my course before they could get a permit to work in the field with endangered species. So I know where these folks are coming from. I know their attorneys because I taught most of them. And all of the studies here on Kauai have been kept at bay. And we're not going to go anywhere until we get some money here to do correct and detailed environmental studies. That's going to give us the answers that we need to go forward here. That's going to tell us the truth of what's going on.
So thank you so much for sharing all of that.
All righty. Thank you. Thanks for having me on. Aloha.
I appreciate that. So, Alan, I had somebody communicating with me. They don't understand who you are relative to defending this position. What would be your best way to answer it?
Private citizen, live in Kilauea. I never have had any relationship with any chemical or agricultural company. Ex-journalist, ex-PR person. Spent 20 years of my life as a medical reporter for the LA Times and the Chicago Sun-Times. And I'm someone who is very interested in scientific protocols and scientific validity. So that's where I'm coming from, that and being stubborn.
Okay. I had an idea. I'm just going to throw it out there, Gary, because I'm a private citizen and you're one of my elected officials.
Mine too.
Here's an idea that I had, and this came out of a meeting that we had recently with Syngenta and Dow. And I want to say that our Senate President, Ron Cochi, was there, and then Scott Enright, the Department of Ag, and Jenny Pressler from the Department of Health was there. There was a number of people in there, probably 60 people in the room, and different conversations came up. People were saying it could be volatilized from when your houses were pesticide fumigated for termites before they're built, a number of things like this. So, Gary, I know that there has been some hair samples from our friend's daughters in Kekaha, and 8 restricted-use pesticides were found in her hair that are used in the fields right near there where they live in Hawaiian homelands across the street, and that there was a total of 36 general-use pesticides in there. What I thought would be a good thing to do, and it's like a citizen epidemiological study, is if we get people who are willing to pay for their own hair tests, and I want to get, I shouldn't name names, but some people who can make sure that it is scientifically done, but to take hair samples across the island, you know, like maybe 20 in each of these towns, and see, maybe we all are getting something from somewhere, some odd way. If we're getting chlorpyrifos and these chemicals that are only being used on the west side, well, then it's volatilizing and coming up and going over the mountain. I'm not expecting that to be the case, but then we would be looking at some real empirical data. Does that sound like something that it would have any value?
You know, Felicia, it does. At the same time, it gets tricky. Any testing that needs to be done properly so it holds up under scrutiny.
Right, we would have to do
and
that.
And doesn't spread fear unnecessarily. So it would have to be done properly. And you could bet that any study at all would come under extreme criticism from the people that produce those chemicals. If it showed that there was pesticides, they would immediately dispute it and shred it. So the best one would come from the recommendations here, the government. An independent, neutral source would do the study. But if they're not willing to do the study, I agree with you that it should be done privately. I have to say, this leads me to one of the most troubling aspects of this whole discussion is the acceptance by government and by industry that it's okay. It's ubiquitous. We should all be okay because that's the world we live in, to have pesticides in our hair and in our water. The state tested 22 streams in the state of Hawaii. Every single stream had pesticides in it.
I remember that.
Every single stream. And when I asked the person that did the testing, I said, what's wrong with this picture? And she says, what do you mean? I said, well, it's not supposed to be there. And she basically said, give it up. You know, that's the world we live in. That's not the world I want to live in. And I think we can move forward and reduce those levels to a certain extent. It's like smog. It's like the Hudson River. It's like, you know, they're dirty. It's fine. Let's clean it up. Let's reduce the amount going into the system.
And I was in that same council meeting, and one of the questions that was asked by a council member was, this is the first time you've ever done the study, and that snapshot was the first time that the water was ever tested for these. And I could tell, and that was one of the council members who is really a proponent of the industry or protector of the industry, and I could see that he was shocked. Because when it is said, there is no evidence that this stuff makes it in the stream, there is no evidence because they never looked. And so once they looked, there in fact was, but it was everywhere. But
and they never looked back. That's the thing,
and
too.
And they never looked
they
back.
They found it, and they didn't. There was no subsequent follow-up studies to see if this is a random occurrence.
Well, the
thing about the drift issue is repeatedly over the last 3 years, the industry says, we follow the label, we follow the label, we follow the label. The report shows drift occurs. It shows drift occurred at Waimea Canyon School. It shows drift occurred into the Kekaha Ditch. Without question, drift occurs.
So right now, the cost of doing all this is coming down to the citizens mostly. And so there's, like, how do people respond? I mean, people need to be making their responses. If nobody responds, the industry was able to respond miraculously in a few hours of it being disclosed. So it's not surprising that they knew what was coming out and that they were prepared, but it was like a drumbeat. You know, right afterwards it came out, that response came in from them. It's important that there is a response from people who want to echo the concern, but it needs to not be emotional anecdotal stories.
Well, the report is out there. It's available. The consultant that did it is asking for public input. I believe the deadline is at April 4th.
It's April 8th, and the public hearing is April 4th, and I have a problem with that it is 4 days before the deadline that somebody comes over and does this explanation. That's one of the reasons why I'm trying to bring this out right now, so people are aware of it, because the implications are profound. And I want to, again, give my aloha to these companies, because what I do see is that they are working on it. What we learned from Pioneer, as they've like dropped like 60%, I could look at my notes, but of their fields because of market changes. And, you know, they've closed down the fields that are across from the houses. They've closed down the fields that are around them. Syngenta has not worked that field since it was, they had the last incident, I think was in 2006. I have a caller. I'm going to take this call, and callers can be very quickly because we're almost at the end of the show. Aloha, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
The World Health Organization maintains that glyphosate is probably not carcinogenic. The European Council, the Europeans, are saying that it might be carcinogenic. That's where the problem lies, I think.
Okay, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
The deadline for providing input, I think, is very important for the public. You mentioned aloha for the companies. I also have aloha for the people that work every day, you know, paying their bills, that work for these companies.
But I also know
that the industry, these companies, mm-hmm. are going to be paying good money to people to diminish this report.
That's right.
So the industry is going to be going full tilt with their commenting, and it's already coming in from across the nation, these national organizations, to criticize the report. And so it's up to the private citizens to try to balance that effort by doing their own research. And I really applaud, there's so many people that are doing this. They're out there doing their original research, and they're just regular moms and dads, you know, working their jobs, but yet they're the part-time, they're looking up.
They're doing extraordinary due diligence, and I'm going to give a shout-out to the Friends of Mahalapu, who have done extraordinary due diligence in being proactive in their area, and that community coughed up something like $250,000, a lot of money. I might not have that number quite right, but I know people were getting, like, pulling some of that out of the equity of their home because they felt it was so important to be able to stay safe living where they're doing.
You're talking about the dairy farm controversy. You're
talking about the poisoning of the water as a result of the dairy farm right. controversy, and having discovered that the water is already very problematic. So what we're seeing is the, like, when I went to one of those meetings, and it was profound amount of evidence that was shared, and Scott Enright, the Department of Ag, said if every community was like this community, Hawaii would be a very different place. Mm. And the governor's liaison agreed. And it takes so much capacity to ask the citizens to do the due diligence of the landowners, of the companies, and the government. And I think for me what this fact-finding study said is like, hey, government, you've been negligent. That's to me what the bottom line is saying.
If we could double back on one point that Gary made for just a second, I think his point about the way that sort of random hair sampling could not necessarily be an effective technique is a good one. I've thought for a long time that a good approach here would be an epidemiologic approach, what's called a retrospective study, where if you went to schools on the west side, schools on the east side, schools on the north shore, and you randomly selected health records for a couple of hundred kids in each place, and you did an in-depth evaluation of what has happened in the family health histories of those children, let's do that, and let's find out whether there actually are differences as opposed to what people think are differences. Yeah.
The problem, and I understand that, and it makes sense intuitively, but if you read, and I've read far more than my fair share, the stories, the Aaron Brockovich stories that happened in communities all over the United States.
Recently.
Small populations, you cannot get statistically relevant data. You cannot. You just can't. They're too small. You need a population. You need much larger populations. And so small communities like the West Side, you're never going to get it.
And it creates a funding issue. We are almost time for Jazz with John. I'm going to ask him if I could throw the county council report into your show. He said he will, because we are just about at the end of this. Alan, I have had somebody persistently texting me asking, are you in any way paid by this industry?
No.
And
in no way.
In no way
paid. In fact, I do have a friend who used to work in the mayor's office, now works at Syngenta. When we have lunch, one of us pays one time, the other one pays the next time if it's a check for $15. No. I have no association, no employment, no compensation. I've been through this a few times. It's not there.
Okay,
and,
final thought,
and my
Gary?
Only compensation is from the Kauai County Council as a council member also. The one final thought, I just want to read from the report. It's been a historical debate over what causes those children, the students and teachers at Waimea Canyon Middle School, when they got sent to the hospital twice. And the report comes out, and it says that there is no definitive cause for those health system symptoms, they were far more related to pesticide exposure than from exposure to stinkweed. That was a conclusion of a former senior scientist with the EPA in Chicago who studied this and reported on this for 35 years.
That's a paper in the appendix, not in the report.
No, it is in the report. And it's on page 80 in the report. I have the page number here.
And I want to just concur that I was at the council meeting when that was presented, and that study was almost an insult to anybody's intelligence who was watching the study that put it at stinkweed. They did a test 2 years later on Maui by growing stinkweed.
I read it.
It was really an atrocity. We are just about at the end. I know that we've only scratched the surface, but I want to tell people this is an important issue. Got to engage. I have posts up on, I will put it on my website too. I don't know if I can say my website. There's no money on my website, FeliciaCowden.com. I will put something up right on the front page where people can go and look at it. I will put it back on my Facebook and on the Kauai Soapbox.
And the report is online, and the appendices are online, there for everyone to see. Yes, it's a dauntingly long document. 105 pages or something, but it's worth investing some time on.
And it's not hard to read, but I did apparently read it too quickly and got too happy and excited thinking that was a reflection of those entities rather than that was a request of them. Marshall, thank you so much.
Thank you, Felicia, and thank you, Gary and Alan.
Yes, and you're listening to KKCR, Hanalei KAQA Kilauea. This has been Felicia with Kauai Soapbox, and Jazz with John is up now, and we have the county council report, and then you will be hearing from our underwriters.
Aloha, I'm John Gordon for KKCR News. Here's a county council report for the week of March 14th. There will be a council committee meeting at 8:30 a.m. on Wednesday, March 16th. Also, there will be two special council meetings on Thursday, March 17th. The first special meeting will be at 10:30 a.m. and is a workshop to discuss revisions to the Kauai County Charter that would result in a new county charter changing the governmental structure of the county from the current system to a council management form of county government. The second special meeting will be at 3:30 p.m. and is a non-public executive session. Subject is evaluation of the county clerk. The meetings will be in the council chambers in Lihue. Here are highlights from the committee meeting agenda. The Public Works, Parks, and Recreation Committee has a request from committee chair for the county engineer and deputy county engineer to discuss the circumstances related to the management advisory report for the fiscal year ended June 30, 2015. Current findings and recommendations for 2015-003, improve monitoring of delinquent receivable accounts. Council Chair Raposo requests the acting county engineer provide a briefing and status on the Honopapi Bridge. Also on their agenda are deferred bills 2612 and 2613 relating to the plumbing and electrical codes. The Planning Committee has in their agenda Bill 2601, Draft 1, for an ordinance amending the county code relating to additional dwelling units on other than residentially zoned lots, and this was deferred from February 17th. The Budget and Finance Committee has communications from the Salary Commission transmitting for council information the Salary Commission's Resolution Number 2016-01 relating to the salaries of certain officers and employees of the County of Kauai for the fiscal year 2016-2017, which was adopted by the Salary Commission at its February 5th meeting. And this is Salary Commission Resolution Number 2016-1 and was also deferred from March 2nd. Also on their agenda are two bills. The first is Bill Number 2616 for an ordinance to amend the county code relating to impoundment fees. Public hearing was held on this on March 9th. And the second is Bill 2617 for an ordinance amending an ordinance relating to the operating budget of the county for the fiscal year July 1, 2015 through June 30, 2016, revising amounts estimated in the general fund, and that's for the Kauai Humane Society barking dog enforcement in the amount of $33,901. And a public hearing was held on this on March 9th. The Committee of the Whole has Bill 2614, Draft 2, on their agenda, and this is a bill for an ordinance to amend the county code by adding a new Article 6 relating to the registration of lobbyists. The council will have a non-public executive session, and the purpose is for the county attorney on behalf of the council to brief the council relating to the management advisory report for the year ending June 30, 2015. Current findings and recommendations 2015-003 improve monitoring of delinquent receivable accounts and related matters, and this was also deferred from March 2nd. For more information, visit the county's website. Until next week, I'm John Gordon for KKCR News. Aloha.
And stay tuned for Jazz with John coming up next. And Jazz with John is made possible by